This is Community Matters on 92 Gold. If it matters to you, it's on Community Matters.
Thank you for joining me here on 92 Gold and 104.3 Kinzu Country for our Community Matters program. And joining me today on the Community Matters program is Reverend Al Hammer. And Reverend, thank you for taking the time to join me today. I am really glad that we could be able to talk because you are in charge of something that's really pretty important here in Warren County. It's a pretty amazing place to be. And when you see this place, I encourage everyone that's listening to this broadcast to make your way out after we're done talking about this to where we're talking about, because it's going to blow your expectations away. Now, with that being said, Reverend, thank you for taking the time to be able to join us today, and thank you for being able to curate this place and take care of it so well that you do, because it's pretty awesome that we have it here in Warren County, and we're talking about the Olmsted Manor and Retreat Center. So thank you for joining me.
You're welcome, and it's good to be here, and I appreciate your invitation. Well, my background is actually, I'm an ordained minister in the Methodist Church, United Methodist Church, and I've served churches all across the country, actually.
Really?
And the last few, I actually trained in what I call leisure ministries, which is recreational ministries in the church.
Oh, wow.
And two of the churches I served, which were in Kentucky and Florida, it's been about almost 20 years doing recreational ministries in a large church. Had full-blown gym, weight room, craft rooms.
Wow.
One church I served had a full-blown ceramic studio, you know, those kind of things. After doing 15, 20 years of recreational ministries, I discovered I was really doing about 75% business side of things and only about 25% of actually programming recreational stuff. So I ended up kind of converting to the business side of church, where I was, you know, running large churches with, you know, full-blown facilities and activities. Then when this opportunity came up at Olmsted, it was kind of the perfect marriage between the recreational side of ministry and the business side of ministry. So I'm kind of combined the two of those to run Olmsted Manor.
Wow.
And yes, in fact, you know, Olmsted Manor is a Methodist-related camp and retreat center, so everything we do there, in fact, our mission there is to provide renewal within a sacred space and an atmosphere of Christian hospitality.
Wow.
So obviously, yes, as having learned all of the faith-based lessons that I have over, you know, 30 years of ministry, bringing those to a setting like Olmsted was actually very easy. Please refer to me as Al. That's my name, and that's what I prefer. But Olmsted Manor is just such a wonderful place. As I indicated, our mission there is to provide a renewal within a sacred space and an atmosphere of Christian hospitality. And that's what we strive to do in all that we do. Olmsted Manor sits on 320 acres in McKean County. We're surrounded by 15,000 acres of Allegheny National Forest. So you can't really help but feel like you're in such a, I won't even call it isolated, it's really more of a sacred place. We have lots of places, including the labyrinth. We have trails, hiking trails that go between us and the community park. We have a trail that goes up over the ridge called the Eagle Trail that was made by one of our Eagle Scouts. And it just is such a beautiful place any season. In fact, one of the things that I've done just to highlight the seasons is that each year at Christmas, we have a Christmas ornament that actually highlights the manor house in a different season. And so far we have done winter, spring, and summer, and this year we'll be doing fall. And it just helps to highlight the beauty no matter what the time of the year.
You know, and that's one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we can talk about with this place, is because when we talk about this manor, people do tend to get an idea in their head of what a manor is, but really, they haven't seen this place. And until you have physically been at the Olmsted Manor, you don't know what it looks like. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about it with this is what I love about the Olmsted Manor. One of the things that I love about it is the construction and the design of the house itself. Now, with that being said, would you be able to go into a little bit of detail and tell us just some of the interesting features about this house, being that it was built, you know, over 100 years ago?
Sure. Let me say that Olmsted Manor has the original manor house, but I'll also indicate that we have several other facilities, including a lodge, and we have a meeting space called Hickman Hall, and there's actually the original carriage house. So there's several different buildings that make up Olmsted Manor. The house was built, started in 1916 and was finished in 1917. The architect was Robert Bodker out of the Philadelphia, New York area. And actually, the interesting part to me about that is that Mr. Olmsted hired Mr. Alling DeForest, who was a nationally known landscape artist. He hired him in 1912. To come in and to do the site work before they even got to building the manor itself. We sit on the side of a hill. I have about 50 acres that go straight up the backside hill behind the manor house. And those 50 acres are just covered with natural springs. In fact, that's where the Olmsteds got their water for over 100 years, just fed down from those springs. And Alling DeForest came in and built cascades and waterways and the whole structure to manipulate the water so that it would elude where they were going to actually end up building the manor house. In fact, there's two waterfalls along the main sidewalk that where he brought the water down, and actually one of the trails of water comes down to what used to be the Olmsteds had a swimming pool. Wow. And the water fed into the swimming pool and then went out through drainage down to the local 2 Mile Run Creek. The manor itself, there's a lot of really cool features about it, and part of it has to go back to the history of the Olmsteds, but we can get to that in a minute. Yeah. But the manor itself, as I said, was built in 1917. It has really cool features. It is 4 stories high, including the basement, 3 stories above the basement, and it has 8 guest rooms that we use as guest rooms. 5 of those were what we call the family wing. The Mr. and Mrs. Olmsted had one of the bedrooms. They had a daughter, Elizabeth, who had a bedroom, and Robert, who had a bedroom. And then they had 2 guest rooms, because Olmsted sits right on Route 6, which is the major thoroughfare across Pennsylvania, about the only way to get straight across to Erie or wherever you were going to go. And so back in the day, if you were of the status that you knew the Olmsted family and you wanted to travel this route, whether it was by horse and carriage or by primitive cars, you would probably contact the Olmsted family and see if you could spend the night there on your journey. And they had 2 different guest rooms for allowing you to do that. Then 3 of the other 8 rooms, well, 3 of those were in the servants' quarters, and they did have live-in folks who helped them to maintain the facilities. I will say, I said that Robert Bodker was the architect, and of course the story, and we have this on our website, but the story always is kind of funny, because Mr. Olmsted hired Mr. Bodker to come over and take a look at the plans he had to build the house, and Mr. Bodker said, "Mr. Olmsted, I can't build this house, this luxurious home in this community of Ludlow. It's just not worthy of such a manor." And Mr. Olmsted said, "Well, if you want to build it, go home. I'll find somebody that wants to." And Mr. Bodker gave in and ended up spending a year building the manor house. It was actually constructed. The contractor was Hyde Murphy, who I believe is still in Ridgeway. They're out of Ridgeway. And the whole interior panel work and trim work on the lower level is out of quarter sawn oak. And actually, the family wing has all quarter sawn oak. And all of that was actually milled and cut and produced right there in Ridgeway. It was put on the train and brought up to Ludlow, where there is a train station right across from the manor house on Overbrook. and they unloaded it in horse and buggy and brought it over to build the manor house. Wow. So, yeah, it was, if you look at the interior of the house, it's interesting to me that you don't find any gold and glitz. You look at the chandeliers, for example. The chandeliers are pretty much basic wrought iron chandeliers. And Mr. Olmsted really didn't do a lot of gold and glitz. He did like the quarter song oak and the beauty of the grain. So he really kind of entailed the natural beauty that he found in the exterior inside the home. His own interest in the beauty of the surrounding forest was a part of that decision making. He also was ahead of his time in many, many ways, and we can get to some of that later, but I find it interesting that when he built the house, he put both gas and electric in the home so that he was always prepared to be able to light the home and do what he needed to do.
And that this house was designed and built in 1916-17. When you're looking at those years, to see the idea come into someone's head to say, hey, you know what? Let's do both. And make it work, too. Make both of them work efficiently. Now, that's just pretty forward thinking.
Well, and I think the part of the reason he was able to do that was, one, as I said, he was quite the entrepreneur. In fact, you almost have to know a little bit of the history of Mr. Olmsted, if I can go there.
Yeah.
To understand how and why he did some of these things. Actually, Mr. Olmsted started out probably as a teenager selling for a company out of Erie. And he ran into a Mr. J.G. Curtis, who was pretty impressed with this kid. And so he brought Mr. Olmsted to Ludlow and asked him to run the general store. Now, at that time, Ludlow was a booming town. Lots of timber, lots of gas, maybe even some oil, those kinds of things. There was thousands of people in Ludlow at that time. In fact, Mr. Olmsted came to run Mr. Curtis's store, but there was probably two or three other general stores as well. But it wasn't too long before Mr. Curtis realized the potential for Mr. Olmsted, and he invited him to go across the street to the J.G. Curtis tannery or leatherworks. Now, of course, the tanneries, there were multiple tanneries in the area because of the logging that went on produced the bark as a byproduct, and bark is part of how you get tanning for tanning leather. And so thus Mr. Curtis had developed his tannery. So Mr. Olmsted did go across the street and started running. He was called the secretary, which I think in today's terms probably meant that he was the chief operating officer. He was kind of in charge of doing, making sure everything worked right. And it wasn't too long after that, probably around 1901, that Mr. Curtis decided, hey, he's doing a good job. I'm ready to go retire. And he sold the Curtis Tannery to Mr. Olmsted, and I think it was five other employees. So it became an employee-run business. But it didn't stop there. It was really cool because Mr. Olmsted was very creative and very innovative, and he brought in a guy by the name of Mr. Phillips. Mr. Phillips was to install this newfangled thing called a generator, which produced this newfangled thing called electricity. Hadn't been around too long, but that was going to help Mr. Olmsted up his production of leather because he could run these new machines with this electricity.
Wow.
So Mr. Phillips installed it, and everything worked pretty good, and Mr. Olmsted and Mr. Phillips became really good friends. And eventually, Mr. Phillips took Mr. Olmsted to New York City. They had to hop on the train and could ride over pretty easily. And so they went to New York City, and there Mr. Phillips introduced Mr. Olmsted to some people, and Mr. Olmsted brought together some of his friends who became investors, and they bought three what we know as lighting company, electric companies. They called them lighting companies, three small lighting companies. It's kind of like today when you have a computer company that, you know, the Microsoft that started in a garage or whatever, and you ended up, hey, they bought up this computer company and this computer and made this conglomeration.
Oh,
well,
okay.
Mr. Olmsted did the same thing. He actually ended up buying about 50 different small electric companies, lighting companies, and put them all together to make Lilco, the Long Island Lighting Company. And they own 98% of the electricity east of New York City, all of Long Island, 98% of Long Island electricity was under their purview.
Wow.
At one point, I saw one article that showed he was either the president, the chairman, the CEO, on the board of over 25, 28 companies.
Wow.
Running these companies. So he was very smart, very astute, and that's where he got his money. So now we go back to the house, and now you begin to understand how he developed this house, and we go back to the point that he put electricity in there. And it's interesting because if you have ever dealt with an old home, you know that most of your old homes have what they call knob and tube wiring.
Mm-hmm.
They put a ceramic knob, you wrap the wire around it, run it to the next one, wrap, run it to the next one, et cetera, all the way down to the tubes, which we would use as fuses or breakers today. And, of course, that's hidden behind all the plaster work. And in our manor house, the plaster is anywhere from an inch and a half to probably 2 to 3 inches thick. Well, Mr. Olmsted didn't do that. He started out the building process with conduit. He put his wiring in conduit. Now, it was the wiring of the day, which was aluminum silver, I believe. But eventually, when they did change over to the more modern copper wiring, they were able to pull the wire and not have to tear into this beautiful plaster work, which if you go into a lot of older homes, you've either tore out the plaster work and they put it back with other materials, or they've got what's called surface-mounted wiring, and you just see these surface-mounted tubes all over the house. But Mr. Olmsted didn't do that. It's all pure and clean and really, really cool. In fact, there's a lot of built-ins in the home. But my question, and I can see it on your face, my question is, how the heck did he get electricity in the middle of 500,000 acres of national forest woods, when even today, there are days when we are out 30 minutes or 3 days. How did he get good electricity even in 1916, 17, 18? Well, the answer to that is that, remember I told you he installed a generator at the Curtis Tannery, which now he owned, and was actually only a couple blocks down the street. So he ran his own wiring from the tannery over, provided him electricity.
People in this area, in Warren County, McKean County, both, they don't really acknowledge all that often that we had an electrical lighting magnate from this area that built such a really cool piece of both architecture and history that's in this area. And that's one of the things that I'm glad that we were able to talk a little bit about, to learn, you know, how he got started with this, because it is just fascinating when you mention that we are surrounded by so much woods here in this area that you're able to bring electricity here and make it so successful.
Yes, and he did a lot of things like that. He did so many different things. I'm amazed, especially back in that day and time when travel took so long and other tasks took longer than we are used to. We're kind of used to the now generation. But, you know, he did many, many other things. The part that fascinates me is that even as you call him, electricity magnet, he was very, very engaged in Ludlow. That was his home. That was his community. That's where his children went to elementary school and high school. That's where he invested himself. In fact, so much so that he had property that now he actually what we call Wildcat Park, which the Ludlow Community Association manages. They had bought several acres and started the park in 1921. But in 1925, Mr. Olmsted gave them 65 more acres.
Wow.
to continue to develop this park that now has pavilions, tennis courts, lots of room for festivals and those kind of things. So he was very invested in the community. They helped to build one of the pavilions. They helped to build a major bridge across 2 Mile Run. Lots of things in the park that they were well invested in. But not only those kind of community things, Mr. Olmsted was also well known for his scouting. He was actually the, and I don't know all the terms, but he was the head guy for the Corn Planter Council. And actually, with that group, he went up just north of here in Warren to what is now known as Olmsted Scout Camp. He bought the acreage for that and got it developed as a scout camp. The legend is that there were more, under his leadership, there were more Eagle Scouts proportionally than there were in all the rest of Pennsylvania, population-wise. So he really believed in developing the boys and leading them in a really good way. So he was very involved in the community. I think that's where we as Olmsted Manor Retreat Center have inherited our hospitality because they had such hospitality.
When people go and take the time and spend it at the Olmsted Retreat Center, what do you think are some of the goals that you have for guests when they come in? Or do you have any goals for the guests when they come in? Or do you hope they have their own?
Well, let me speak to guests first. And that is, I think people need to understand that we have several levels of guests. And I will start with kind of the main theme for us is that as Olmsted Manor and as a United Methodist Church related organization, we provide educational, Christian educational events probably about 20 times a year, 20 to 24 times a year. So once or twice a month, we offer some kind of event where we can bring people in for a day or two or 3 days where we bring in really good leadership and teach and help them. We have a prayer retreat coming up the first weekend of March where people can learn how to pray like Jesus. That's the name of the retreat. So we do a lot of our own programming to help facilitate and promote the really good theology. But beyond that, we also host a lot of other churches, and there are many denominations. You don't have to be United Methodist. We have Episcopal, Catholic, Baptist, Presbyterian, you name it. We have a lot of different denominations that come in and do their own retreats, whether they're spiritual retreats or whether they're staff training retreats, whether they're denominational group retreats. We do a lot of other retreats for other denominations. So that's another aspect of bringing the churches together. But we also are open to other kinds of groups that are not necessarily religious, but yet I think we can still provide a Christian atmosphere. And these are groups that I call, one of the larger kinds of groups is what I call crafting groups. We have quilting groups. A lady up in Olean has a quilt shop. She has her clients at her quilt shop, and she brings them down, six or eight of them, and they have a retreat for a week or 5 days where they bring in all their materials and equipment, and they sew and make quilts for a week or for 5 days. We have knitting groups. We have scrapbooking groups, you know, all kinds of different craft groups that come in for several days. And for me, that's also a form of relaxation and bettering yourself to learn new skills. So we do those kind of groups. But even beyond that, and I think this is the really coolest part, is we actually have individuals and families who come in and will rent a room or whatever just to get away, to relax, to grow as a family, to take advantage of the many aspects of the national forest that surrounded us, whether it's hiking, biking, snowmobiling, you name it, they come to do it and stay at Olmsted. Our rooms are basically a really nice hotel room. The only thing that we don't really offer that a hotel room offers is telephones and TVs, but who needs it?
Some things kind of detract from the experience.
Right.
And when you talk about telephones, you know, TVs, things like that, they really do. And when you talk about a retreat center, especially when you think about the location of where you're at, It feels to me, at least, like a place where you're better off to just shut off your cell phone when you get there and just enjoy being in the moment and being, you know, physically around the other people that you're with and actually thinking about that stuff. And when you look at some of the other buildings and things like that on the property, were those, I mean, those were constructed a little bit later, right?
Well, let me first tell you a little bit about how it became and why it was handed off to the United Methodist Church. And that to do that, I have to give you a little bit of history of not just George W. Olmsted, the proprietor, but his wife, Iva Olmsted. Iva and George got married in 1904. They had their first child, Robert, in 1908, and their second child, Elizabeth, in 1912. Iva was not just a sit-home, sit-around-the-house kind of woman. She was a go-getter. In fact, there's lots of stories. She loved to garden. In fact, at the height of the time, she had 14 gardeners on staff, and she was right out there with them, digging and planting. In fact, there was one point they had over 10,000 tulips they planted, red, white, blue, yellow, you name it. In fact, it was so beautiful that when they came up in the spring, it backed up traffic on Route 6 because everybody wanted to stop and look. So Iva was very important to the manor house and to the hospitality that was shared there. But what you got to know about Iva Olmsted is that her dad was Reverend Thomas Groves, who was a Methodist minister in the region. And so she was very much into and worshipped at the Methodist churches locally, where her dad served, or for a good amount of time, both she and George were worshipers at Kane First United Methodist Church in Kane, and she did a lot around there as a volunteer. So she grew up in the Methodist Church as a PK, a preacher's kid, and continued to serve in the Methodist Church wherever and whatever she did. So when it became time, and let me just share that George Olmsted actually passed away in 1940, but Mrs. Olmsted continued to live in the manor until 1960. I believe she fell and broke her hip and became needed a lot more help, and I think her daughter, who lived up in the Chicago area, I believe, had helped her to get into a nursing home in the Chicago area in 1961. In the later 60s, probably about 68 or so, they began a discussion about what to do with the manor house. I believe they had some caretakers that were kind of keeping it up somewhat over that period of time, but they finally ended up deciding to give it to the Methodist Church in honor of her parents and her involvement in the Methodist Church. Wow. So that's how it came to be the Methodist Church. What had to happen was, actually, we received it in 1968, became official in 1969. We dedicated it November 1st, 1969, and began to develop it into a retreat center. At the time, there were several buildings on the campus, including the manor house and the carriage house are the two main ones. There was actually a building called the Bungalow, which Olmsted continued to use for several years as a kind of a jumping-off start for a lot of youth groups that went on canoe trips. They would come and stay in the bungalow, which is kind of a bunkhouse. Wow. They'd stay there and then go from there up to the Canadian rivers or wherever they were going to do their canoe trips. And I often, very often, talk to people, older age people now, who very clearly remember staying and the joys of they had of staying in the bunkhouse. The bunkhouse has since been torn down. It was not in real good shape, but we have in the meantime, the 1980s built Groves Lodge, Groves being the name of her father, so it was in honor of her mother and father. Groves Lodge, which had 12 rooms and was a basic hotel-style room, as I've already said, that helped provide between those 12 rooms and the 8 rooms in the manor house. And then we also have two rooms, a two-bedroom apartment in the carriage house. Between those 22 rooms, we were able to begin to have pretty good groups that could do a lot of things. In 1980s, late 80s, 90s, We built Hickman Hall, which is a meeting space. That's basically all it is. It'll seat about 60 to 70 people, lecture style. Has bathrooms and a small kitchenette. And then in the 90s, late 90s, we came back and built an accessible wing onto the Groves Lodge. So we call it the Annex, but it is totally wheelchair, handicap accessible with elevator and the whole works. And it has 6 rooms. So we now have 28 rooms that can facilitate a wide range of needs, whether it's families to come and stay in the 2-bedroom apartment for a week, do their own cooking, and be on their own, or whether it's somebody who wants to stay in the lodge with a group and have... we actually have a dining facility that will hold about 50 or 60 people, and we provide food service for the people. Any group that's over 8 people will provide food service for. So we have added a bunch. It did take a few years where a lot of stuff had kind of overgrown with not being paid attention to for a few years, but it all came back and we ended up, as you said, built. And I have to say, the hospitality, the Olmsted family continued to support that with Groves Lodge. They helped to financially support that, as well as Hickman Hall with funds and their continued support.
What are the best ways that people can find out more information about what you have available? Would you recommend people to go online?
I hate to say this because our hospitality representative is Ann. She's probably going to shoot me for saying it, but I think the best way is to call us and just to talk and ask and do the same thing you're doing, is ask the questions. I think the one-on-one kind of personnel, personal hospitality is the best. That's what we're about, is hospitality. Obviously, you can go online and see the basics, what kind of buildings we have, what kind of rooms, there are pictures of the rooms, what the costs are. You can find all that at olmstedmanor.org. That's our website, www.olmstedmanor.org. And I have to always remind people that Olmsted is spelled with an E, O-L-M-S-T-E-D, no A.
There's 2 things that I wanted to mention before we wrap up the program, because they're both pretty interesting things to be able to talk about. One of the things that I wanted to mention is just how awesome and unique the property is from the outside. And when you talk about the landscaping and the work that's been done, I mean, you can see the amount of effort that people had been doing over the years to make this happen. Because when you see the different like walkways that there are and the old fountains and things that exist on that property, it's just absolutely gorgeous to be able to walk through.
And there's no better place than to go up to what we call the tea house. It's a gazebo up on the side of the hill. Very popular for the deer. Almost any time in the springtime, you'll see deer grazing up on this particular hill. But this is the tea house where it's called the tea house because Mrs. Olmsted would often go up there in the afternoon and have her tea, her afternoon tea. So yes, there's many, many. I get no better joy than when I see someone sitting out on a sunny rock, mellowing in the in the atmosphere. It's, yeah, such a beautiful place.
Absolutely. Now, one more thing that I wanted to mention is a little bit of a trick that this house has up its sleeve that's up in the attic that I wanted to mention. And I think that this is just a really fascinating piece because I'm a bowler myself. I love bowling. And just to see the old Brunswick sign that you see up in the attic is just absolutely amazing. And really, I think that the only person that could do this the most justice would be you to talk about this. So, Al, would you mind telling us a little bit about the attic that you have up there?
It's sure.
Pretty awesome.
And you call it an attic, but I don't even think that justifies it. It's really the fourth floor. It's just a beautiful space. They put a bowling alley up on the fourth floor, mostly because you could get the full span. It's a legal-sized bowling alley, certified by Brunswick, built in 1917, and it actually has 2 lanes, and it actually has 2 different games that you can play. It has 10 pin, which is regular bowling, with regular size pins and regular size balls, but it also has duck pin, which is a smaller pin and a smaller ball. And I'd say back in the day, they probably had, when they were entertaining, they'd have guests go up, and they might even have 2 different tournaments going on, one with 10 pin on one lane, and duck pen on the other. And the interesting part to me is that there's actually a side room off of the bowling alley that actually has windows that open up to the bowling alley. So I imagine those who were not involved in the actual bowling games would be in that room, maybe having their coffee and tea and hors d'oeuvres, and would watch the games from those windows. And it's interesting because this was, of course, before the day and time of automated bowling alleys. So there actually is what I would call a semi-automatic pin setter. You would take and use a lever to lower the pin setter down to the floor. The servants would be back in what was called the pit and pick up the pins, set them in the pin setter. You pull the lever up, and when you bring it back down, it sets the pins in the right place.
Wow.
So it's a semi-automatic, but they actually, and the interesting part to me is that was made right over here in Smethport. And I think the company is still there, but they don't make that kind of thing anymore because it's just not needed. But anyway, it's made by the Backus Company in Smethport.
There is so much use of local materials, local labor, local wood, local craftsmanship in making this house that it's really awesome to be able to see it, because really it kind of seems like the best, I don't know the best way to put it, but it seems like a golden trophy when you look at the representation of all the materials that are in this area, you know? It seems like a best use of every different material that they have in this house.
Yeah, if you come and look at the lots of stone walls built all over the property, and of course we're trying to, you know, control how the water comes down, but lots of stone walls, and all of the stone was gathered from on the property, and these stone walls were built, and here they're standing 100 years later. We've had to do some repairs, but they're still good solid walls that have maintained for a good amount of time for the facilities.
Absolutely. And you know, when you see the gates, as soon as you see those big grand entrances, you know where you're at.
Well, and let me speak to that, yeah, just because we've got to acknowledge that the gates were actually handcrafted by an ironworks artisan by the name of Samuel Yellen. He was well known all over the eastern seaboard. He had iron gates at Yale. He had iron gates at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. He has iron gates at Bock Tower in Lake Wells, Florida. And Mr. Olmsted had him build the iron gates there at Olmsted. Actually, three sets. There's one, the main big gates as you come into the driveway of the manor house, and then the main entry gates down on Route 6 that you come in and go up the steps to the manor house, and then a side set of iron gates that come up the steps off of Church Street. So he said, Mr. Yellen made these for Mr. Olmsted. I understand, and this is just by kind of grapevine, but I understand his granddaughter still is making those kinds of things. He was out of the Philadelphia area.
That's really amazing. And, you know, that's just one more example of just excellence in craftsmanship shown in this facility. Now, thank you for taking the time to be able to talk with me today, to be able to highlight this and teach us a little bit about the Olmsted Manor.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Community Matters. If you have any questions, inquiries, or suggestions, feel free to reach out at warrenradio.com and click Contact.